Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we're looking ahead to the January transfer window. We're finding signings for Manchester City, for Liverpool, and then over on the paid side, we'll pick players for Arsenal and Manchester United. We also open up the burn book before, on anything but football, we bring you our festive gift guide 2024. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another two episodes. As I said, I'm Patrick and I'm joined by Peter Dorman, who is, I just realized that you're wearing a lot of branding.
Wait, two brand. Well, one's not even a brand. And I would say
the colors are the same and one is more objectionable than the other, I would say.
The colors just look the same in this dimly lit light. Okay. Dimly lit room. One's actually navy and one's black, which in my opinion is actually a bit sacrilege. It's something I never wear together because they
blue and black?
Specifically navy and black, but yeah, I try and avoid blue and black as well.
Yeah, they need to. Blue and black, I think, are okay if they're like.
It has to be really blue.
If they're very clearly different. But people say the same thing about brown and black, and I actually think brown and black go together really well. Blue and black to me is much harder to make work than brown and black is.
I think what people are talking about when they say brown and black, they're thinking of tan and black.
I don't think that's true. I think people have literally been taught this rule that like brown and black don't go together. And then when you actually see someone wearing brown and black, like for example, most Le Maire or Stouffer like lookbooks, it always looks great. It looks really good.
There's also so many shades of brown that you can just make something work with generally anything.
Exactly. But anyway, you're wearing navy and black and you're wearing Lad Bible on the chest,
sure.
Tato on the dome.
Yeah. The Tato hat was a Secret Santa present from work. And I've also got multiple Guinness Nitro Surges with me that I haven't opened yet. But yeah, very brand heavy. I am sitting in my loft room on a Wednesday night. I didn't think that my sartorial choices were going to be put under the microscope on this audio podcast, but I probably should have expected that. How are things with you, Patrick? It's very nice to see you this evening, and it was nicer to see you last week in person for the first time.
It was lovely to see you in person. See you and the wife. And yeah, it's nice to be out without the kids. Well, obviously with your kid, I guess, in tow.
In utero.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, coming along, for basically piggybacking.
Yeah.
On Jess. But yeah, I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm getting through, you know. I'm still adjusting to my glasses.
Mm.
They still feel a bit weird, but they make me feel smart.
Was that a necessary addition to the previous Patrick Van Straten?
I mean, it's probably made me more insufferable. Mm. And also because I bought the other day, because my house was freezing, I got two of the Uniqlo like roll neck thermal tops.
Yeah.
To keep me warm.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't really plan to wear them out, but now I'm thinking I'm gonna wear them out. Because I keep catching sight of myself wearing like a black roll neck and my glasses in the mirror. And I'm just like, look at this fucking Architectural Digest.
I was just about to say, you suddenly feel the urge to map out a house.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to get blueprints for a house.
I'm like, where's my protractor gone? I'm sure that I can draw a chimney. I'm good, man, in conclusion. But today, we thought we'd look ahead towards the January window, and we thought we'd take a few of the top clubs in the Premier League and try and find like one signing that they should make, both position and player. We decided to leave Chelsea out because honestly, maybe we'll do them later on, but like, to be honest, buying new players is not really an issue that Chelsea have. We've also left out Spurs for now. We may well come to them later on. Teams like Aston Villa we may come back to. So today on the public side, we're going to be talking about Manchester City and Liverpool. And so Pete and I have brought one player each for each of those clubs, and then on the paid side we'll take a look at Arsenal and Manchester United, who are playing tonight. So who knows, by the end of that we might be like Arsenal and Manchester United have very different needs to the ones we thought. Okay, so I reckon we should kick off with City because they're obvious, and because we all assume City are going to go wild in January because of where they are on the table, because things are clearly unsustainable as they are, because Pep's staying an extra year. But while we all assume they need like a Rodri backup, there aren't that many names on the market, or there are names where I'm like, that doesn't work. So recently they've been linked to guys like Eduardo Boe, and they've been linked to Rocco Reitz, like these like young midfielders who, when you look at their stats, you're like, that guy's not ready to start for Manchester City at all. And beyond that, it's just basically like, no, they'll just go for Zubimendi. And I think everyone assumes they'll go for Zubimendi. But Zubimendi also said he wanted to say Sociedad. And clearly, I don't know how hard Arsenal went for him, but they were definitely interested and he wasn't. Liverpool definitely went for him and he wasn't interested in them either. So we're all just assuming that he's going to be willing to go to Manchester City, despite the fact that Man City might be like, here's a massive contract, and then... I guess that if they sign you up to a big contract and then they get like forcibly relegated from the Premier League, you'll just have a free
like
release.
A break clause, yeah.
Yeah, there'll be like a 30 mil release or whatever, and you'll be like, right, great. So I'll get paid by Man City for 3 months and then I'll go to... Well, exactly. So I just like, imagine moving your family to Manchester and then 6 months later, you've got to leave on a free. So I don't know. I don't know how appealing the Man City project would be to Zubimendi, who clearly is someone who's very attached to Sociedad.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I find this idea of who you sign for Manchester City to be a slightly complicated question, and not only complicated for the reason of who's going to go under these circumstances, but do they need just one player? Like, there are issues all over the park at the moment, and the idea that if Rodri were there, everything would be fine. I think if Rodri were there, it'd be a lot better, but I don't think it would just all be fine. I think there are a lot of problems right now.
I think City are a very, very interesting entity at the minute, and we've always spoken about how, like, while they're a great team, we've criticised them for being like overly reliant on Rodri and Haaland scoring. And I think that's become very, very evident this season with Rodri's injury and the fact that Haaland's cooled off of late. Basically, since Rodri got injured, Haaland's scored twice. Since the middle of September, Haaland scored twice in the league. Before that, he had 10 and 5. So, like, the two things that we said might or have the potential to derail City both happened at the same time. Rodri got injured and Haaland went cold. But, like, outside of Rodri, KDB's obviously, like, 33 now. India's last year of his contract and has just got these injury issues now. So you've got that to navigate. Kyle Walker has seemingly lost huge amounts of his unique selling point in like his ridiculous pace and like that physicality that he had. And you just look across the pitch and you're thinking, there are multiple holes to fill in this squad that has been like by far and away across the, Pep era at City, best team in the world. Like consistently at least. Like they won 5 of the last 6 Premier Leagues. They did the quadruple. Like this team's incredible. But I look at the squad and I can see, okay, there are multiple positions where you could look to actually say we need to bring in someone. And also there's an added caveat with the fact they do have these charges looming over them. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility that they will face like a significant, maybe not like a relegation, but like a transfer ban of some sort could be very well around the corner for them. So if you're on the kind of inner circle of City's kind of recruitment team, you might be looking at the next few windows thinking, we kind of need to do stuff now, like this window or maybe summer, because we might not get the chance for the next couple of windows. And like, remember what happened with Chelsea? Like Chelsea were lucky because they appeal and then it got delayed, so then they could do all their business very, very quickly across like two windows and then had a one or two window ban. Whether that's for City, I'm not sure, but it is very realistic that they could get at least some form of transfer ban, which kind of expedites the need to fill a lot of these holes. But when I was looking at their needs and the kind of player that I would want to bring in, like you say, a lot of people are talking about like a Rodri replacement or like a Zubimendi type. A lot of like big names and big money being thrown about. And I agree that I think they do need more of a Rodri type person in their squads for that when Rodri is not available or when Rodri starts to age out. Like he is only 28 at the minute, of course, so he's got loads of time left. But so much of the City's play style is built on Rodri making them an incredibly hard team to press, or a team that just bypasses presses so easily because he's so good on the ball. He's just basically press resistant. And getting another player in that can do that at least partially as well, I think will go a long way to City looking like just a slightly worse version of themselves without Rodri than like a considerably worse version of themselves when they don't have Rodri. But my issue with people linking like Zubimendi and stuff is that you're going to have to go and spend. Even in the scenario, say he wants to come, say he accepts, which I don't see him doing. He's already knocked back two Premier League clubs. I don't think this will be a different scenario. But say, just for hypothetical sake, he is willing to come to City. You're going to have to go and spend a ton of money to get him, right? And he's going to come. He'll land in Manchester. He'll play probably pretty good, even if he's not like for like with Rodri. He'll be pretty good. And you'll get to like the start of next season, maybe coming into winter next season. And Rodri will be kind of theoretically back up to speed, back up to fitness. He is the best defensive midfielder in the world. He's just won the Ballon d'Or. Like, when that happens, you're like, okay, yeah, well, Zubimendi, you're great, but we currently have the best defensive midfielder in the world that has been potentially the most integral and important part of this system or making the system work.
Sure.
He's going to start. So then
I think they could totally play together. Because Zubimendi's not a real holding midfielder, sure. I think, in that sense. And like Kovacic played alongside Rodri. Like they obviously brought Gundogan back, and Gundogan played beside Rodri as well. Now Gundogan was getting into the area more than Zubimendi ever will, but I don't see any reason those two guys can't play together.
I can see a world where they definitely can play together. It was more of a concern that I had about if you're going to spend that amount of money for a player that you're then going to play as DM and then Rodri's going to come back, you're going to have to move stuff about to accommodate that starting level player, or at least that starting costing player.
But they're quite old in midfield. But
Rodri's not that old. Well, I suppose, okay, well,
no, but the rest of the midfield is.
But you're not going to replace De Bruyne with Zubimendi. You could probably replace the Gundogan, Kovacic.
Sure, but you could. But then your three-man midfield could be like Zubimendi, Rodri, and like Foden long term, you know, with wingers and with Haaland. Like I don't know, I think that's kind of feasible. Like, or even Grealish could be the De Bruyne replacement. Like he's probably more similar to De Bruyne than everybody else they've got in the squad.
Is Grealish more similar, do you say?
Yeah, I think so. Like Grealish's creativity and his ability to drive through midfield, I think is like the closest thing they've got to De Bruyne in the squad. That's not to say he's like just like him, but he's put up loads of chances, created his ball retention's really good. He's a one-on-one threat. He's an intelligent passer, and I think he does his most damage through the middle of the pitch. But like, I don't know, like I worry about that less, especially because like money's not real to them. Pep signing
it might
up
become very real.
Yeah, but Pep signing up for another year, I think, is like definitely them saying, we're going to spend. Like, there's no way Pep signs up for another year and then in January they're like, we don't want to spend 60 mil on the midfielder you want, because like, you know, that's actually not how we build a squad. They're just going to do it and just like continue doing financial crime, aren't they? Like, who gives a shit? I don't think they give a shit, but I know what you're saying, as in like, in an ideal world it'd be better to get somebody who just like, I don't know. Like, is there a better thing to be done here? Like a guy who can play instead of Rodri or alongside Rodri? Is that not exactly what you want?
I view them being two approaches. So I think what they don't want to do is spend a load of money on emojis. So I've covered my face with the research so that I don't just look at myself and I look at you. But means that whenever I gesticulate and it triggers the Zoom calls, like emoji
reactions. You did a load of
reactions.
Balloons. Okay, so you did a load of balloons, and then we also did the like thumb, the little for some reason a thought bubble that has a thumbs up in it.
Yeah,
but anyway,
I never know that I do it, but I know by your reaction that you just start giggling.
It just makes me laugh.
Like,
it's just
like completely out of place in the middle of a sentence.
You'll be talking so seriously, and in the middle of it, like just a bunch of balloons float up around your head. It's great, and you're always saying something like, "And Manchester United are fucking rubbish, and they need to sack their manager," and it'll be like, hey. Anyway, but, I'll let you finish. I'm sorry.
What I think they don't want to do is go out and buy like a like for like Rodri guy for a ton of money, and then be in a situation where you've got this like truly elite, world class, best in class player that is Rodri, who coming back from injury, and then you have to work out how do we give minutes to both of these guys, or how do we give minutes to this like 80-90 million pound signing that we signed just to get through this ACL period that Rodri's suffering. The two approaches you have is you sign somebody very, very expensive and very good and like absolutely nailed on ready on the brink of superstardom that can do a lot of the Rodri stuff, but then can also do stuff that he doesn't do, so they can coexist in a midfield where they play slightly different roles in whatever system you choose to play them in. Or you go for like a younger, slightly cheaper guy who could be good, needs to age in a bit, but like won't be out of place or won't feel out of place or that he's hard done by when Rodri comes back and he spends a couple of years as a rotation option. I think those are your two approaches if you were City.
Yeah.
So
agreed.
On that, who have you gone for? Because I think we're both in agreement that we've both gone for defensive midfielders here, right?
Yeah, we have. Because like I do think there are issues with the attack, but I think De Bruyne playing more regularly helps there if he can. Looks like he's playing tonight and they scored early.
There's so many entities up there that they'll be fine.
I think Pep just has to figure that out.
Yeah.
Like I think if you're Pep, you're like, or if you're like the director of football or whatever, you say like, Pep, I'm sorry, bro, but like you won the league with this attack where you didn't even have Haaland, so you've just got to work this out. I'm sorry.
Since Rodri got injured, Haaland's like, he's the biggest underperformer for his XG in the league.
Yeah, it'd be fine.
And he's like over double Calvert-Lewin, who's second. So like Haaland will just start scoring again. Even if he doesn't start like bagging tons like he did at the start of the season, he'll still start scoring, and City will just pick up wins that way.
The Liverpool game aside, City put up a lot of XG in all the games they lost. All of them. They put up like over 2 XG against like Spurs, against Bournemouth.
Haaland did over 2 XG against Southampton on his own.
They put up quite a lot against Sporting. Like they put up loads and loads of XG. But I was like, I think they should honestly, seriously consider spending like £125 million on Baleba. Like, he looks extremely special.
Mm-hmm.
He's 20 years old. He's playing really well in the Premier League. I think you'd have to sort of train him to play the Rodri role. But whoever they get in, they're not just going to be like, play this role like you're Rodri.
Nobody can do it.
Exactly. They're going to have to. And even Rodri struggled. Do you remember when they first brought him in for Fernandinho? Yeah. They looked so porous for a while. Like, it's a role that is fitted around his skills. But with Baleba, I think you could say, we can play you as a six. And when Rodri comes back, we can play you as something else. Because he's playing a much freer role this season. And honestly, I think he looks super special. And like, if money doesn't matter, fuck it. You can get him. The other things they could consider, Frenkie de Jong will have like 18 months on his deal in January. I don't think I'd do this personally because his injury record is spotty. His wages are huge. But like for likewise, if you just wanted to bring someone in and say, you've just got to play like Rodri's role, Frenkie de Jong is probably one of the best candidates you're going to get. And he could play with Rodri as well. Like play as a more advanced eight type. Like he's got the ability. The other thing is, if we're talking nine figures, tempt Real Madrid with Camavinga.
These are punchy suggestions.
If I've got 100 mil and I'm like, I need a midfielder, I need a six.
Yeah.
Who can maybe play a bit of eight as well. Then I'd say, well, I want Camavinga. Like, he's the best. He's the guy I want. And I don't think he necessarily leaves. I don't think Real Madrid maybe want to sell him. But I think it's at least worth saying to them, like, do you have a price for Camavinga? But beyond that, I was just like, right, okay, I'm going to go for somebody a bit cheaper. I'm going to go for somebody you can resell if he doesn't work out, and he'll be fine for now. And that is Rovella, who I mentioned previously. I can't remember who I mentioned him for, but he's at Lazio. I think I may have mentioned him for like Liverpool or Chelsea or something. So Nicolò Rovella, he's technically on loan from Juve, but I don't remember the terms of the deal. Like, it's probably one of those like 18-month loan to buys. He's in his second season at Lazio as well. He's been at Genoa, he's been at Monza. He's been at Juve. He actually turns 23 today, the day we're recording. But he already has over 100 top flight appearances, which is good, especially in Italy, especially as a Juve loanee, where there are always these guys who bounce around and they're suddenly 24 and they've played like 50 league games. But he's been a regular everywhere he's gone, basically, except for Juve. And really, like, there are two boxes this guy needs to tick. This guy needs to be able to defend. He needs to be able to pass.
Yeah.
And I guess as part of the defending thing, he needs to be able to run, because there just aren't legs in this midfield. Like City tonight are playing a midfield three of Gundogan, De Bruyne, and I think Bernardo Silva, something like that. Oh, Grealish. No, they're playing De Bruyne, Grealish, and Gundogan as a midfield
Grealish
three.
Grealish got legs.
And I'm like, that's okay when you are playing a team that you're like, we're just going to blow these fuckers away. And I do think with Man City, the whole plan has been built around control for a long time. When that goes out the window, it's better to entirely give up on control than do a bad version of control, in my opinion. You know, if you do a bad, it's like pressing. If you half press, teams will just play through you. Yeah. You're much better off playing a deep block or a mid block. Yeah. Like, so I think they just need legs in the midfield. And Rovella, his passing is obviously nowhere near Rodri, but it looks really good, especially for a young player. He's on the ball all the time, like 70 passes a game, 5 progressive passes and 5 into the final third. That's really solid for a guy of his age. It would probably go up at City just by virtue of being at City, because everyone's numbers go up at City. And he's done that everywhere he's gone. You know, he's done that at Genoa. Like, so that feels pretty stable. I think that's like a rock bottom level of production you're going to get from him.
Yeah.
It's also actually roughly where Rodri was when he was at Atleti. Like, those were the numbers Rodri put up when he was at Atleti, because obviously, you know, he's improved. He's played under the best manager in the world, and your numbers get juiced by playing for City. Now, there were signs that Rodri was a special passer, you know, like he was over 80% accuracy on his long balls. So, like, you know, that's a good sign. Ravella's at 70%+ on his long balls, though. So he's not really a slouch in this department. And passing wise, he's not going to embarrass you. Mm-hmm. I think he's pretty good. Defensively, I think he's getting better and better. So, you know, 2 seasons ago, he was winning like a third of his tackles, which is honestly, if you're in central midfield, it's not like the worst thing in the world. Like, it kind of depends on the role you're asked to play. But he was at 36% of his tackles. Then last season, he was at 44%. This season so far, he's at 60%. Yeah. So I would like, in an ideal world, I'd wait a whole season and see if that sustains.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have that luxury. We've got to fucking sign someone. Yeah. And his volume is really good. He's winning the ball back like 5 times a game, which is excellent stuff. He doesn't really dribble, but he also doesn't lose the ball. He picks up a load of loose balls, like loads of recoveries. The downsides for him, I'd say, like, he does commit quite a lot of fouls and he's not amazing in the air. But
yeah,
I don't really care that much about that. Like, he's not the biggest guy, but I just don't think that, like, Rodri's aerial...
I fully agree.
Like, power is like, fucking, who cares? Yeah. Like, is it important?
You can make that up elsewhere.
Exactly. Is it important? Yes. Is it the most important thing? No. Is it even in the top 3? No.
You're not signing Rodri because he's amazing in the air. If he's not...
Exactly.
If Rodri didn't jump once, you'd be like, fine, we'll sort it out elsewhere. Do the other things you're amazing at.
Yeah, I'd be like, let's make Haaland drop into midfield. That guy's fucking huge. Like, let's do something else.
Yeah.
Or Gvardiol can tuck in. But anyway, there's also a load of that stuff that improves with age. You know, like, aerial duels tend to improve with age. Making fouls, that stuff tends to improve with age, obviously up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, whoever they sign anyway, this is somebody, you're going to want to play them with Kovacic and maybe with a third guy, like Gundogan, like Silva. Like, you're going to have to do that, whoever you sign. I think you're going to have to do that even if you sign Zubimendi. So,
sure,
it doesn't matter, I think, that there are these flaws in his game. And so I think he's very good. I think he could potentially be great. But the main thing is, right now, he's going to fucking throw himself about, win the ball a lot, and then pass it forward competently. And I was thinking about this, and I was like, there are always these, like, old fucks who are like, football's actually a very simple game, you know, all that kind of thing.
You are your Sunesses?
Well, I actually remember, like, Rory Smith once was on, like, some football podcast. I can't remember who he was talking to.
Who's Rory Smith?
He's now the head football writer for the New York Times, but he was at, like, he was at The Times, I think, before that.
I'm thinking of Rory Jennings. I'm like, no, fuck Rory.
But Rory Smith was like, I remember once I was listening to a podcast with him, I think with Marcotti, where he said something like, you know, my dad always used to say to me, football's a very simple game. And Marcotti was like, no, it isn't. That's bullshit. and also, I think about Fabian Delph saying, like, you know, football's really simple, lads, you know, in the documentary, the All or Nothing thing.
Yeah.
And Pep immediately says, like, no, it isn't. Mm. Like, I don't think football is very simple, but I do think that sometimes the reason you're losing football games is very simple.
Sure.
And I think if you have no one in midfield who can run or tackle people, it's very hard not to lose football games. Yeah. Like, Manchester City have so much talent. They have the best manager in the world. They've got no one in the midfield who can run and tackle people. And so they've lost a bunch of games on the trot. Like, that's how it is. It's not just that, obviously, but, like, put in very, very simple terms, that is a version of it. So I think Rovella would be a really good signing for them. I think he'd be expensive, but not crazily so. To me, the more complicated part would be, like, you know, working out the deal with Lazio and Juve. But he's an exciting young player, and he's 23, so he's, like, ready to go, but yeah. not like I have to play every minute. I think, you know, he can come back. He could play till the end of the season and then get bits and pieces of minutes over the next 2 years, at the end of which Rodri would be 31.
Exactly.
And then Ravella would still only be 25. So yeah. like that works for me.
I've gone for somebody who is basically like for like in this role, both in terms of age, profile, boxes ticked, because for me that is the most sensible approach that City can make, is a guy yeah. that doesn't need to be, like, he can drop in the team and be completely fine at the minute, but doesn't need to play every single minute for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
But by the time you're looking to phase Rodri out, this guy's up to speed and should theoretically be like top class defensive yeah. minded midfielder. And I think that is the most sensible way to go for City. I considered Leverkusen's Ezequiel Palacios. But
great player.
You did a fantastic profile on them last week or 2 weeks ago as a potential Toni Kroos replacement for Real on the Patreon side. So no point in rehashing over that, but if you want to listen to that, go over to the Patreon side and pick out the, what is it, like a, what was the title? Like a Real Rebuild?
Something like that.
It was from one or two episodes ago. But the player I've gone, a very, very similar profile to Palacios, also very similar to Ravella. I've gone for Angelo Stiller at Stuttgart.
Okay, so cards on the table. If I were in charge of Man City, this is the guy I'd sign.
Really?
Yes.
Would you have picked him had you not seen that I'd prepped him before you got to prepping City?
I thought about him, but I just kind of wanted to see. Honestly, I kind of wanted to see if I could find a name I hadn't really read about.
Sure. But with Stiller, he's very similar to Ravella. He's 23 years old, 6 foot. Left-footed defensive midfielder. He's a little bit lighter on the defensive end, but he is
this
a more...
This season he is.
He's
been all right the last couple of seasons.
Sure,
defensively,
but he's...
Right.
When I look at him as a defensive midfielder, I don't see like an opposite shutdown defensive midfielder. I see expansive, deep-line playmaker that can defend. So he is a more aggressive and expansive passer. But he's just been super involved in everything that Stuttgart have done over the past couple of seasons. Like, he was responsible for 14% of Stuttgart's entire completed passes last season. And this was a season where Stuttgart had 60% possession. The only two teams that had more percent possession than them in the Bundesliga were Bayern and Leverkusen. So, super ball-heavy, ball-retentive team. He's involved in basically everything they do. That season, only five players in Europe held a higher proportion of their team's completed passes, and one of them was Rodri. So, straight away... There are parallels between the role he's playing at Stuttgart and the role that he could feasibly play at City. Big, high percentage, high passing, dominant team where the central midfielder is doing a ton of passing. Doesn't have to be like amazing passing. Like, he's not spreading like 70-yard balls that are spitting two lines and setting up for a player free, but he's keeping the ball moving. He's making it really difficult for people to properly press or effectively press. This is the kind of role that he's done so well at Stuttgart over the past couple of seasons, and it's the kind of role that we've come to see Rodri do so well as well. Like, overall, his passing and creation numbers have been fantastic this season. He's at like 0.25 expected assists per 90, top 3% in the Bundesliga, 2 key passes, 9 passes in the final third. He's got 93% pass completion for short and medium passes. So all of those balls, you expect him to be retaining possession and playing out from the back. Super high completion rate on them. He only plays about 6 long balls. He completes 6 long passes per 90, but at a 72% success rate. So a little bit down on Rodri, but still very, very good. Top 15% in the league. This isn't Rodri level stuff, but you're not going to get Rodri level stuff. And you don't necessarily need to get Rodri level stuff right now, because Rodri will come back. This is someone who does a lot of the on the ball stuff that Rodri does, and is a really good age and will develop, but won't need or feel the need to be like, I am now City's defensive midfielder.
Yeah.
And it doesn't create that like imbalance or that like kind of weird dynamic in the dressing room. This is a very clear like progression path.
Yeah.
And I feel like that dynamic kind of works with Stiller. He is a little bit lighter on the defensive numbers, but like nothing concerning. There obviously are league effects here, because this is Bundesliga versus Premier League. But if you compare his numbers this season to Rodri's, I think I've done this over the past year, just because obviously Rodri's not played for the last 8 games. But he's pretty similar to Rodri in numbers for like interceptions, blocks, clearances. He falls back a little bit in tackles. He's about 30% lighter than Rodri. He's also about like half of Rodri's aerial presence. But like we just said, I'm completely fine with that. You can make that up elsewhere. And he's significantly down on like Rodri's progressive carries in general, like on-ball take-on carrying abilities. Also kind of fine with that if you just lean into his passing. Like, he doesn't necessarily need to be able to carry the ball or be an amazing ball carrier through the middle of the pitch if he can do it effectively as a passer. While Rodri does all of that quite well, or really well, I'm kind of fine with it just being like, okay, this is what you do. Play within your skill set and we'll still be completely fine. I think he's very, very gettable in January too.
Definitely.
For market, like somewhere probably between 30 to 40 million euros, I think you could get him across. And I think this would be a player that is a good age. Exactly the same thing that you said about Rovella, that by the time Rodri's aging out, if all goes well and he kind of develops the way that his underlying numbers suggest he can and will, he will then be approaching peak age defensive midfielder, able to kind of take on the torch that Rodri's going to leave behind. And I think this is sensible. It's not spunking a load of money. There won't be a big ego. Like, this guy will, if this guy comes, he will come from Stuttgart and be like, what do you need me to do? I will do it. If you go and get like a Camavinga or even like a Barella, they might come. Camavinga certainly will be like, right, I'm here to like do what I do, as opposed to like, what do you need me to do? He will come from the Stuttgart team at this age and be like, this is my step, this is my chance. I'll do anything to kind of prove myself at this level. And I think that's exactly what City need. And I think in many ways, the way that the season's gone so far, it makes it easier to sign a player like this. Because we spoke a lot about Liverpool and like the situation with Trent and Conor Bradley and stuff, when we're like, you just want to give Conor Bradley minutes because it looks like Trent's leaving and you kind of want Conor Bradley to be like properly up to speed. And he looks like he's a great player, but you don't want him to be coming in like light on minutes and experience. But also Liverpool are like the pace setters in the Premier League at the minute. So they can't really afford to risk results just to bed in a new player to help bridge the gap between Trent and by pre-Trent and post-Trent. Whereas City are 11 points back from Liverpool now, currently I think fourth or fifth in the table. Opt to have them at like a 4% chance of winning the title. And if City went on a massive run, did crazy things and went on to win the title, I wouldn't be shocked. Like, I wouldn't be like, oh my God, that's like unbelievable. It would be unbelievable in the like colloquial sense that it's an incredible achievement.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be unbelievable in the sense that like how could this ever happen?
Yeah.
However, nobody actually, the expectation for them to win the league at this point is the lowest it's probably ever been in the Pep era. So you kind of get a little bit of a roll of the dice here. You can take a little bit of a swing here because as long as you finish top four, it's not a disastrous season. You've won five of the last six Premier Leagues. If you don't win this one, you're like, oh well, sure. Like, do we really care that much? If it serves City as a team and as a squad long term, they're in a position now where they're not necessarily forced to have to keep pace or have to set the pace to be the front runner in the title race. They've got this stage now where they're like, sure, it'll be really tough for them to win the league, and if they don't, nobody will be shocked. It's kind of in a weird way, it's kind of a nice position to be in if you're trying to sign a player like Angelo Stiller.
Yeah, and then, you know, Stiller's also a guy who, like, post-Pep will still be a good, like, peak age midfielder that a bunch of guys could get use out of. You know, like, there are some players, like, when they signed Nunes, like, I don't like the player, but I was also just like, if anyone can get something out of him, it's Pep. The problem is, once Pep goes, you're going to have, like, a mortal manager who has to try and work out like how to make this guy work. It's kind of like Trent, like we talked about last week. I think Slot's a really good manager, but Klopp was able to work out a system that allowed Trent to do all the Trent stuff. And Slot's way of getting a lot out of Trent is to have him play as a much more conventional fullback.
It's total waste.
Lots of managers just would say, my system isn't about you. My system is about the system.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like, so in that sense, I think Stiller's like a good guy because it's not like the next manager is going to think, okay, I need to have somebody to cover for him in X, Y, and Z respects. Like, he'll be a useful guy for anyone.
Yeah.
All right. Well, shall we move on then from a team trying to make up the gap to a team that are setting the pace, which is Liverpool. So Liverpool, straight away, I'm going to say, we all know they wanted a midfielder in the summer.
Yeah.
We assume they still want a midfielder. I've not gone for a midfielder.
Neither have I. I think they're kind of fine. Okay. Now, Gravenberch has been great. McAllister has been good. Endo's still there. Like,
agreed.
Manageable. Trent can play there if you need. Like, it's fine.
And I'm trying to be realistic. Like, I just think Liverpool look at the market, same as they did in the summer, and they're like, if the right player isn't available at the right price, we don't sign anyone.
Sure.
And
Michael Edwards is a smart guy.
And so I thought, you know, where's a place where they might actually lose some games? And I think it's clearly left back. They could obviously try and get in their, like, Salah replacement now or whatever if they expect to lose him, but it's not really going to happen.
They also have enough entities up front as well.
Like, exactly. And if Salah gets injured, you don't win the league. Like, that's how it works.
Sure.
You know, it's like Arsenal got Odegaard injured and had a couple of red cards, and now they probably won't win the league. City got Rodri injured and now might not win the league. Like, that's how it goes. But I think they could lose some games at left back.
Interesting.
Like, I think Robertson has looked very shaky this season. And Tsimikas is okay. He's been there a while now. if he was gonna establish himself as Liverpool's first choice left back, he'd have done it, and he hasn't done it.
That's a good point.
So I think that this is a place, I think this is a position that's gettable in January that you can do that's not, in a way that's not insanely expensive. And some of the names who've been linked to them, so like Kerkez, like there are even rumours they were in negotiations for Kerkez from Bournemouth. Ryan Ait Nouri.
Yeah.
They just don't feel very Liverpool to me. Like, unless Kerkez can be had for just a really good price, unless Bournemouth say, look, we're not going to get in the top four, we're not going to get relegated, you know, so, like, today,
not,
for example...
Not Liverpool in what sense?
They're going to be overpriced.
Okay, so Michael Edwards won't pull the trigger on them because they're not valued for money.
Ait Nouri, I think, is not as young as he was when they were first rumoured to be interested. He has played as a left wing back, largely, and he's been very good there, but he hasn't been, like, world class there. It just doesn't really make sense to me. Kerkez, I think, looks highly promising, but he right now doesn't look particularly good, kind of like one-on-one defensively. And you're going to have to pay finished product money, I think. Now, it's possible that's not true. So, for example, today, Kim McCauley, like, in the Transfer Flow newsletter, wrote about some midfielders people could be interested in, and she put Lewis Cook in there. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons she put Lewis Cook in there is she was like, Bournemouth can just sell in January. Like, Bournemouth aren't going to get relegated. They aren't going to get the Champions League. They could get, you know, Conference League or something, but they could do that either way.
Yeah.
January might be a good time for them to say, if you want our player, you can have him now at like a 15 mil markup. So from that point of view, maybe they would do a reasonable deal for Kerkez. But I don't know. If you want him in January, I think you're going to pay like 45, 50 mil for him. Liverpool just don't do this except for game-changing players. I think they should probably try and beat Real Madrid to Alphonso Davies, like going on a free in the summer.
Yeah.
If I were Liverpool, I would definitely go to him and be like, come to Anfield. It's a fucking massive club. It's also a club that's... Liverpool's also massive in North America. Like, we've got a great coach. Like, you'll bed in with the language. It'll be super, super easy. And we're going to give you a free role. And who knows? We might even play you on the right-hand side sometimes. Like, we'll give you plenty of minutes all over the shop. Like, why not? And that'd be interesting. But that ship might have sailed. So, I wanted to get a Liverpool-type player, and I've gone for Yorel Hato, who is at Ajax right now. So, he's 18 years old.
Yeah.
Everyone loves him. He's playing left-back this season, but he's also played left-centre-back.
Mm-hmm.
He's just under 6 feet tall, but given that he is 18, he's probably still growing. And to me, this is a guy who can play a bit of left-back now and may well turn into your long-term left-back, but who can also potentially turn into your long-term left-sided centre-back. Like, they're going to be thinking about that over the next few years, and I think that it's a smart way for them to approach it. Like, it's like Arsenal signing Timber, right? Like, Arsenal were like, Timber can play right-back for us, he can play centre-back for us, he's played a bit in midfield, he can play left-back. Like, fuck it. Like, this is just a guy who's problem solves, and that's actually how it's proved with Timber. So I think Hato would be great. I mean, he's really quick. He's technically fantastic, you know, like most Ajax players. He's actually got 6 goal involvements in 12 this season playing left back. And it's not like Ajax are the Ajax of the past who just destroy people. Like, Ajax have had their struggles, and Hato's been there for a while under a bunch of like up and down managers, let's say.
Sure.
He's actually at 0.2 expected assists per 90 minutes, which is really, really strong. 5 progressive passes and 1 pass into the penalty area. So when he gets forward, he is useful, but he also does a load of useful stuff the rest of the time as well, like in build-up play. And as we've said a ton of times, if you are going to get somebody out of the Eredivisie, you want them to look like a total mismatch for the league. And at 18 years old, he looks like a total mismatch for the league. Like, his aerial win rate is already good at a really young age. He's at 82% tackle success at a really young age.
Yeah.
Like, that's quite remarkable. And if you look at his European appearances, he's played mostly in the Europa, those numbers are fairly stable across that. His ball recoveries, his win rate, his tackle success, all of those are fairly stable across his European appearances, which also gives me a little bit of confidence. You know, like, mm-hmm. teams in the Premier League on average are probably, you know, are at or slightly below Europa League level, the majority of them.
Yeah.
So if he's pretty good in the Europa League, he'll probably be good enough. And the other thing I like about it is it just doesn't bench Robertson. You know, again, it's one of those things where, like, if you go and sign someone who's just like a starting quality left back, then you've got Robertson, whose career I don't think is over.
No.
And you've just basically got to get rid of him or say you're our backup for the next few years. And,
well, he'll just want to move on, won't he, basically?
It's quite an expensive player to keep there. And, I don't know. I don't really think it's that good for the squad to say to a guy who is looking ropey right now, but has been one of your top-level performers for a long time, to say, you're a bench player now.
In a period where you're potentially about to lose Van Dijk, Trent and Salah, all in 1 to 2 windows, removing Trent from that squad, or removing Robertson entirely from that squad, you're like, well, we've lost a huge amount of identity and, like, leadership from our most successful modern era.
Yeah. I mean, that would potentially be like 4 first team players down in the course of 6.
Four of the 5 most important players from that era. Henderson and Alisson being the other 2. One's already gone.
Yeah, like, that's actually pretty rough stuff. So yeah, I don't know. I would probably, like, be loath to just, like, bench a guy like that straight away. I think it's bad for the team. Whereas Hato can rest Robertson. Mm-hmm. He can play instead of him. You can give him minutes at left centre back in cups. And he can play alongside basically anybody there. And because he's 18, he's not going to mind being a bench player. He's going to love learning from some of these guys. He also arrives at a team that has, like, a pretty sizable Dutch core now. You would have him playing on the left-hand side, where he might have Van Dijk next to him, Gravenberch, like, in midfield there, and Gakpo in front of him on the left wing.
Yeah.
Like, that's probably, like, quite a good situation for him. I just really love the player. I think that he's the kind of guy you sign and you think, we have absolutely no worries about giving this guy minutes because he'll get them somewhere.
Yeah, I think it's a really good shout. I would prefer it to have happened before Robertson's declined quite as much as he seems to have this season, but that was kind of unforeseen.
But I just don't know how, you know, he's played, like, every game for such a long time. You have no idea, like, how much is actually left in his legs if he gets some decent rest.
Nobody really saw Robertson's drop-off being quite as substantial as it is so quickly. If Robertson was just a little bit... if his output was a little bit more similar to 2 seasons ago this season, and you bring in someone like Hato, it's a little bit easier to like transition that, because you're not feeling like you're potentially at risk of losing games because of Robertson's decline, but then having to rely on an 18-year-old coming from Ajax to be like, right, now you need to really step up, and, like, there's no real time for you to find your feet. You just need to be ready and go. Really, that's a lot to ask of an 18-year-old, but I do think it's really exciting and interesting signing, and I think it does feel quite Liverpool.
Yeah, I think this is the thing. Like, we can come up with guys for these teams. Man City could do anything, but a lot of the time, like, we know that Liverpool are not going to go out. Like, there were rumors Liverpool were going to go out and try and get Nuno Mendes off PSG.
Yeah,
they're just not going to do that. They're just not going to do that. They've got, like, 4 other positions they need to think about. Why the fuck would they do that? It's just not plausible. So I think I'm trying to go for a move that I would see Michael Edwards making. And Liverpool are more confident than a lot of teams at recruiting out of Portugal and the Netherlands. And they've largely been successful doing it. So, and I think this is one of the you never get a sure thing, but this is closer to a sure thing than some of the guys they've signed. So I just really like him. And I think, like, what's the worst case scenario? Like, you're going to spend, what, 40 mil on him?
Yeah.
And then, like, after a couple of seasons, maybe he's worth half that. They just sold like Sepp van den Berg to van den Berg to Brentford for like 25 mil, having barely used him. Like, if they can get 28 mil for Fabio Carvalho, I'm inclined to think that they could get most of their money back on Hato, even if he doesn't work out.
Yeah, I think it's a good shout. I've gone for somebody. All right, so your reasoning or your thought process behind it is similar to mine, weirdly, again. Like, we actually, neither of us discussed this in terms of like the player profiles we're trying to fill, trying to find, but I've inadvertently kind of gone down the same alleys twice now. I've gone a little bit more conservative, a little bit less, I guess, spicy, not spicy, a little bit less sexy than a Dutch 18-year-old that could be an incredible player in a few years. I've gone to try and be a little bit more stable in a time that could potentially be very unstable for the because of the departures of Van Dijk, potential departures of Van Dijk, Salah and Trent. One, two or three of or all of them. But I have gone for a left-sided centre-back who can play left-back, similar to you. So you went for left-back and play left-centre-back. I've gone for a more left-centre-back, kind of looking towards Van Dijk might leave, and it doesn't, so you're not scrambling next summer, but also is a genuine left back. Like 10% of his last 50 appearances have been at left back. It's not like when you get an attacking player who's like a left winger and people say he can play on the right as well. When they say that, they mean like you can put him there, you can be very good, and he doesn't do it very often, but like you could if you wanted to, but he's actually left. Like this guy actually is a completely capable left back. And I've gone for Nico Schlotterbeck from Dortmund.
Okay.
It's not as sexy as yours, but I think it is sensible. And he has big passing numbers, very good defensive numbers.
I like the player.
Obviously, this is another Bundesliga player, so you need to take that into account. But like, it's not as if Dortmund have been like a particularly dominant team this year. They're sitting fifth in the Bundesliga. They've won six, drawn two, lost four. Like, this is a guy that's outputting big passing and defensive numbers in a team that's completely fine. But he is a very, very interesting player. He's 6'3", left-sided, left-footed, centre-back who also plays legitimate left-back. And I think that is very, very attractive in a world where you have a oddly steeply declining Robertson and a Van Dijk that might not be there next year. Age-wise, he's in a good place, in my opinion. You know, he's 25. He turned 25 this week. So he's still on the right side of peak. You still get all of his peak years. But I think, and this is kind of one of the most important reasons why I went for him over somebody younger, I think there will be there's a potential of a big leadership seniority vacuum that happens at Liverpool. If Salah, Van Dijk, Trent, Robertson all become, you know, all cease to exist in the squad or become less significant in the squad. And I'm not saying that Schlotterbeck could come in and be like, I'm the leader here, like I'm a huge voice, but having the experience that he has, I think will go quite a long way in a team that is a little bit unstable and a little, like we saw what happened to Chelsea in the early Bully era where they lost like Thiago Silva, but they signed like a load, like a ton of 20-year-olds. And Chelsea kind of looked like a bit of shambles for a long time because there was no real leadership. There was no real, like there was nobody to manage tough situations and the kind of things players just know how to do once they've got a certain amount of experience. Mm-hmm. And Schlotterbeck has that experience. He's got over 10,000 minutes in the Bundesliga. He's averaged over 29 90s across the last three full seasons. And this is Bundesliga seasons too, so there's only 34 games. He's already played 11 90s in the 12 league games so far this season. German international, played at the Euros, started four of the six Nations League games that just happened there a few weeks ago. Like, he is genuinely good top level Bundesliga. Genuinely good senior experience. But he's still young enough for it to be a good move. He can still develop, but you're not kind of, you don't need to wait three, four seasons for him to become a kind of finished-esque product. He is much, much closer to that product and it's much easier to drop him in and be super effective or at least completely reliable from day one. If you look at his underlying numbers, very, very strong, over four tackles, interception per 90, nine progressive passes. He actually is the 13th most progressive passer in Europe's top five this season of any player. And only six of those top 20 have a higher progressive passes per 90. So he is very, very involved in progressing the ball and doing it at volume. He's also completing eight long passes per 90, almost two progressive carries. ranks highly for basically all passing metrics and all tackling metrics, and 60% of his touches are in the middle third. So what that says to me is that he's a really quite attacking-minded centre-back who's good on the ball, progressive passer, and is very, very used to being in a kind of like a high line or an aggressive team that their centre-backs or their left-back, when he plays left-back, but particularly centre-back, is on the ball around the halfway line or higher, which is a thing that you would expect a team as dominant as Liverpool to. Their defensive line will be quite high, and they'll expect their players, certainly in the slot team as well. He asks a lot of that left-sided Van Dijk role in terms of passing and progressive passing. He's doing that at Dortmund. He's doing a lot of that at Dortmund, and I feel that that's quite a natural transition that if you, even if you play him there in cup minutes, just to kind of bed him in, see how you feel about playing him there if Van Dijk doesn't sign a contract and leaves. I think that's totally fine. He is totally capable. He's shown like fantastic passing metrics, and his defensive numbers are really, really solid. And, you know, he's only winning about 2.5 aerial duels per 90, but he is winning them at almost 80%. So,
yeah, he's really good in the air.
We've already spoken about like a Van Dijk replacement not needing to necessarily, like this was a couple of weeks ago, not necessarily needing to be amazing or as dominant in the air as Van Dijk, because you've got Konate. This guy is good in the air. He just doesn't compete for a load of stuff, but when he does, he wins it. So there's a world where you could be like, right, you just need to compete more, throw yourself a bite more, and his percentage will go down, but his aerial duel wins will go significantly up. And that's kind of, you're fine. Like who cares if your percentage, if you're 50%, if you're winning like 6 aerial duels a game.
Like relative to fullbacks as well. Like it just like, who cares?
Yeah. So I can see this. I can see him work specifically as a left-sided centre-back, but I think he'd be totally fine as a left-back Robertson replacement because his creation and his passing numbers are great. And this slot system just demands less of what Robertson and Trent are known for. Like, he doesn't need to be as insane as a creator as Robertson or Trent were, because that's not what slot is asking for. Like, if you look at the assist numbers since, like, in the last 10 years, assists from fullbacks in the last 10 years, it's insane. So I think Trent is at, like, 59 assists. Robertson's at, like, 56 or something. And then the third person, I can't remember, it's, like, 25. So Robertson and Trent are truly, like, not even a league of their own. They're like 3 leagues above on their own from the rest of the league and the rest of the league's fullbacks. Slot clearly doesn't want to lean into that as anywhere near as much as Klopp did.
No.
So a more traditional defensive, solid left and right back that are good on the ball and can pass through the lines and can kind of create from deep when needed. This guy ticks a lot of the boxes, and he has that versatility to play as a left back, as a left-sided centre back. I would be confident in him being good in a slot system and doing that Van Dijk passing role well enough for it to not be catastrophic and at least give you a couple of seasons to figure out, okay, maybe we go and get like the next wonder kid and they then bed in, and by the time they're 20, you know, 21, 22, Schlotterbeck is 28 and maybe takes a little bit of a backseat. I can see that happening. That feels kind of sensible without putting too many eggs in one basket. Money-wise, I think you're probably looking a little bit north of €50 million, which is a little bit punchy. But he is kind of, it is January, and he's just ready to go. Like, you're dropping him into a team, and he's a German international. Like, you know he's going to be completely fine without much of a risk.
And I think sometimes
you've got years left as well.
Sometimes you pay more in January because, like, you're in a hole. Like, you know, Man City or teams in the relegation battle. Sometimes you pay more because you're like, we've got a chance to win the league. And, like, from Liverpool's point of view, they're like, well, we were going to go and get probably a couple of centre-backs anyway. And now we can just like, we can add one here and yeah, okay, maybe he's going to cost us like 10 mil more than we'd like. But if we end up winning the league,
it is completely fine.
No one will give a shit at all. It's totally worth it.
Konate's involvement has already been like a little bit in the last few weeks has been questionable in terms of his fitness and stuff. Having that extra player there that can then help bridge the gap, view like post whatever happens with the contracts, I think it's really, really attractive prospect for Liverpool and complete left back. It just makes a lot of sense, and you don't, in my opinion, you don't run the risk of them not being ready to play at the level. I think they've proven that they're ready to play at the level, and they've got that experience that I don't think it's that much of a risk. I think it's quite safe, and they can have at least like 5 seasons at Liverpool and be completely fine. And in 5 seasons, they'll be 30. Okay, they can even have 3 seasons at Liverpool and be 28, and you can move them on if you've got like a more longer term Van Dijk Salah-esque, Van Dijk level, potentially, standard of replacement, you could be like, okay, we've kind of outgrown you, but that's fine. And you could still move them on for, I don't know, a reasonable portion of what you bought them for.
Yeah, agreed. Without, let's move on to the burn book. Okay, burn book time. Pete, you're starting this week. Let's start with what you're taking out of the burn book.
Okay, so what I'm taking out of the burn book this week are Saturday nights in. So the first line I've got on this is that I'm doubling down on the Scrooge old person vibe, but that's because I figured that this would come after my first entry, because we normally go in. But yeah, this is just me showing my age of a man, you know, in his mid-30s, an introvert in his mid-30s, completely comfortable and happy with being both of those things. But staying in on a Saturday night, one, it's fantastic, but it's kind of a novelty to me. And not because I'm like a, I don't know, fucking Jack the Lad. Even though your wife is convinced that I'm just such a hockey lad, which is kind of fairly true. But generally speaking, Saturday nights in have been quite rare for me, mainly because of hockey, because it's like, over the past 20 years, Friday nights have kind of been very quiet because of the kind of expectations of the Saturday afternoon. It's not like a Sunday league standard where you can go out and get pissed the night before. Certainly in my 20s, it was taken very seriously. So Friday nights were very quiet. Saturday nights were like the night where you kind of had to make up for that. And even though now I'm like in my 30s and I haven't been to a club in like, I don't know, outside of stag dudes, I haven't been to a club in maybe 8 years. No, 6 years. Saturday night outs are still like going out for dinner, or after hockey, you stay around for a couple of beers and you get home at like 9 or 10 o'clock. That's still classed, in my opinion, as a Saturday night. Maybe not a Saturday night out, but definitely not a Saturday night in. A Saturday night in is very, very different in that you're literally like, you're home at 6 o'clock if you're out there, and then you're just in for the whole night. You have dinner, you have maybe open a bottle of wine, have a few drinks, watch something on TV or watch a movie, go to bed at like 10 o'clock. And we did this a couple of weeks ago, and it was honestly just delightful. And it was something that I had not done in so long. So I think we had dinner. I think we watched Lord of the Rings Fellowship. I had a couple of drinks. We sat on the sofa with a cat. I think we were in bed by like 10, half 10. And I just got in the bed and I lay in bed. And I had no intention of going to sleep for like another hour or two, whatever, because I generally fall asleep quite late. But I was lying in bed at like 10, half 10. And I was just thinking, this is class, because I'm going to get so much sleep. I've got this all to do again tomorrow. I've got a free day tomorrow. Tomorrow's Sunday. No work, nothing. Free day. I'm not going to have like a hangover to contend with, because I've only had a couple of drinks tonight. And I've just had a really, really pleasant evening. Didn't spend any money. And it was just something that like, it kind of, I was lying there and it kind of hit me, being like, I've had such a good evening and I've not left my house. Like, I've had a nice evening with my wife and my cat. I've not had to speak to anybody outside of this. And like, that's not to say I'm like totally against speaking to people. I have friends who I enjoy socializing with, but there's just something about having a lovely evening in your house, not having to do anything, not having to put on any airs or graces. Like, it was just very, very accessible and relaxing, and I got in the bed just like very content with the evening, knowing that I then had another day of, you know, free will to do what I pleased, and not having to like navigate a stinking hangover or anything like that, or like think about the amount of money you spent the night before, whatever, things like that. It was a really pleasant change of pace. And it's something that, generally speaking, throughout the last like 15 years of my life, hasn't been overly consistent or regular.
I get that. I think this is a really good one. I think sometimes just like, well, I say sometimes, look, you're preaching to the choir here, obviously. From my point of view, my ideal kind of evening is a nice evening which doesn't like interfere with my bedtime to any extent at all. That said, I've gone out a couple of times recently and had like a sort of more adventurous evening, I guess. But like, generally speaking, I do think like I just want to be able to go to bed and get up at a normal time. Like my getting up time never changes. So I need my bedtime not to change too much either. But I like this one. And sometimes, you know, it's nice to remind yourself of the fact that you spend all this time trying to end up with a nice house and like a nice partner. Yeah. And then you spend the whole time like complaining about like, why do we spend so much time at home? Like, well,
I'm so happy to be at home.
Yeah, me too. Okay, on a similar note, what I'm taking out is like tidying your house.
Okay.
So I'm a big like, I find it very hard to relax when there's like a lot of clutter.
Mm.
I've always felt my whole life, like when there's clutter, I feel like I'm like holding my shoulders in. You know, like when you go into a shop that has a load of like trinkets or like crockery or whatever.
Well, like you don't want to bang into it.
Oh, I spend the whole time scared that I'm going to bump into something and like knock everything off the shelves. Mm. It really stresses me out. And similarly, when the house is like that, I'm just like miserable the whole time. I feel stressed. I don't feel like at home. All I want is to just like, well, I don't want to get up and tidy, but I just want to put it, I just want to put it to rights. Yeah. But even a cleaner, it's like a cleaner will clean your house, but they won't like tidy it. They're not going to like solve clean and tidy problems two different things. For you. Yeah. So I'm kind of like, no, I need to actually like tidy stuff. So recently I've been making an effort to do this, and some of it is just like practical stuff. Like, so I don't know. This isn't necessarily a thing of tidying, but like a bunch of our cupboards would just end up staying open the whole time because they were like those push to open ones. Mm-hmm. And so it was really hard to kind of make sure that they would stay properly shut. And so what I did was just remove all the push to open stuff and just put like door handles on them.
Yeah.
And now they stay shut and my house feels like much less stressful. So that's one thing. Another thing is we had a cupboard under the stairs that was an absolute disaster. Like it was just like, it had suitcases in it, had a bunch of other shit in it, mm-hmm. had all our like, you know, vacuum and stuff. Also had like all our tools in it.
Is your current house or your old house?
Yeah, current house. So I just got like a massive toolbox that has like multiple levels in it. And I just put all the tools in there. Mm-hmm. And now that cupboard is tidy. And when I go in there to get something, I know exactly where everything is and it doesn't stress me out anymore. And this sounds like bullshit. And to be honest, you know, like it's not the most exciting, but like it's very small wins when you've got kids. It's very easy to feel like your house is kind of out of your control, like quite rapidly. And so this makes me feel more relaxed when the kids go down in the evening. It makes me feel more relaxed at home. It also just makes life easier to go out and find shit. And I don't know, it makes me happy. And sometimes as well, I'm just like, I'm really lucky to have this house.
Yeah.
I'm really lucky to live here. It makes me happy to live here. And so one of the things that makes me appreciate it more is just to keep it in like relatively nice condition. So that's what I'm trying to do at the moment. I've become like quite house proud. And actually, you know, obviously we only moved here like just over a year ago now. But, you know, my attitude too is like, I've spent a long time working in this house now. Like over that year, I've started working from home much more over the last year.
Yeah.
And when it's not just where you live, it's also your office. It's also where your kids are growing up, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's also where you like have most of your quality time with your partner. Then I think, well, then effort put in here is like kind of doubly rewarding. So that's my boring shout. What are you putting in the burn book?
What I'm putting in the burn book is Christmas paraphernalia.
Ooh.
And I think I'm gonna get a lot of hate from this. I reckon I'm gonna get hate from Emma. I'm gonna get hate from this from Jess. I'm probably gonna get hate from this from Jess's family as well, all of whom listen to the podcast. But I like Christmas. So like don't get me wrong, I like Christmas. I just think the Christmas paraphernalia is all a bit too like pick me vibe. Like chill out. Just take it down. You know when you like meet a person, like a random person, you don't know them, you just met them for the first time. But they've got this like really unpalatable energy, like very high energy, and you're like, you're just a little bit much for this scenario. I'm gonna need you to just dial it down like a little bit to level yourself off. I feel like this with like Christmas decorations. So the thing I love about Christmas is primarily like the social aspect of it. It's like the one time of year you get to see a load of people, like a load of friends and a load of family that you don't get to see enough.
Yeah.
Or very, very rarely in the same room together. And Christmas is that kind of collective time where, generally speaking, you get to do those things a lot more frequently than you would do in the rest of the year. Maybe the only time. So, like, it's great to see your friends. It's great to see, like, your family. I love all of that. But the rest is shit. Like, it's just unnecessary fodder. Christmas trees. Crap. Why is there a 6-foot-plus tree indoors? Why is that celebrated? Crap. Twinkly lights. Crap. Distracting, waste of energy. Like, light is functional, it's not decorative. Like, the twinkly lights are basically stationary fireworks, which in themselves are nonsense.
Oh, interesting.
Miss me with that. Wreaths, worst of them all. Like, let's hang some foliage on the front of our door. That means that it makes it more difficult to enter and exit my house.
Every time
I leave the house now, I get caught on this fucking wreath and nearly pull it off the door every morning. And it's just like, for what? Who's benefiting from this? Nonsense. And what's worse, which actually really weirdly ties into your segment there about having things neat in their own place, organised. We live in London, right, which is a famously densely populated area where square footage is very, very expensive. And generally, most people's houses, if you've got a loft, that will have been turned into a loft conversion room. So storage is at a real, real premium in houses in London. That is just the way it is. So I'm currently sitting in our loft room, converted loft. We have eaves behind me, but we've just got a small, thin, little like eaves of the house that you can use for storage. And that is our main area of storage. And I always thought it was pretty small, and it is pretty small. But Jess put up the Christmas decorations last weekend. But I went in, got out all the stuff, got out the big 6 foot tree in its big red bag, got out the two big plastic boxes of all the ornaments and decorations. And as I took the second box out and like got to the door and turned back and looked at the length of the eaves, I was like, it's actually quite big in here. Once I've taken out these three things, the tree and the two Christmas decorations, I was like, there's actually quite a lot of space in here. Like, we're finding nooks and crannies for random stuff because we don't have enough storage in the house at the minute, because we're obviously like moving shit about for the arrival of the baby. And I'm just like, there's actually kind of a lot of space here that is taken up by all of this Christmas paraphernalia that is out on show, in my opinion, unnecessarily so, for like what, maximum 30 days of the year. But it's taking up all of this very, very valuable space in our storage compartment in the eaves. Whereas if we didn't have it, all of the stuff that we're struggling to find space for, we'd be like, I reckon it would all fit in the space that the current Christmas decorations are taking up. And I get the people like Christmas, I get the people like the festivities and all that. I think it's a bit much. I think it's overrated in terms of the aesthetic of it. The one thing I will accept that is different is if you have young children. I think if you have children, go full on in, make that as like magical as possible. Completely fine with that. I think that's very, very good to do. But I have not been a young child for a few decades now. I don't need it in my life, and I haven't needed it in my life for the last like 15, 20 years. With a young child that's sentient enough to like know what's going on, so in a couple of years,
yeah,
sure. Like, we can do that, and we can run that for the next, I don't know, 15 years, and I'll hate it, but it'll be fine, because they'll get joy from it. 15, 20 years, whatever. But I reject the fact that I've had to suffer for the last 20 years with all of this Christmas decoration nonsense that, in my opinion, is wildly unnecessary. You remove all of that stuff, Christmas will still be good, because it's about like the people and the kind of the things and the connection that you have. The decorative stuff, nonsense.
Yeah, I kind of own with this. We are the family at the moment, though, who have like all our decorations up, because Emma's very focused on children.
Well, exactly.
Emma's kind of like, I just want it to be magical for them. And the first day,
completely support that.
Coco came home from nursery, and Emma had put all this stuff up in the garden, and she literally like gasped when she saw it. It was actually amazing.
I completely support that, but that is a completely different entity entirely, because that you're doing that to entertain and enhance your child's life. I'm saying that the adults, well, I probably can't speak for Jess, because she would argue that it does enhance her life. Does not enhance my life in any way. It actually makes it more difficult. Yeah, also, like, every night going to bed, having to unplug or switch off like 40 different fucking sections of lights. Like the tree, you've got the stuff on the hearth, you've got the stuff at the fucking front door or whatever. I don't know, like, we don't have that. But like, we have like, okay, it's two things, but still, it's too many.
It is bullshit as well that you do actually legit have to unplug the Christmas tree lights.
Yeah.
There's never just a switch. Like,
but also,
I don't like pulling things out of plugs like all the time to turn them off.
But even if there was a switch on it, I wouldn't feel comfortable that it wouldn't burn the house down.
Yeah, that's true.
Because there's like things like your fridge. Like your fridge is like impenetrable. Like your fridge stays in, plugged in all the time. Like, he's the OG, or they're the OG. Like, you know, you can trust them. This little fucker that turns up for 30 days a year but stays in your house all the time. Like, that's shit that'll burn your house down.
Yeah. Okay, what I'm putting in the burn book, it's just a really quick one, but, like, true crime. Like, I'm as invested in it as everybody else. But like, it is clearly bad for us, like, as a people.
What, to like celebrate the depravity of it?
To be interested in it. It's just bad for us, like, very clearly. So there's a new documentary on Netflix, which is like about JonBenet Ramsey.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched it and I didn't really know much about the case. And like, I don't know. I'm not that interested. But like, I've since read a thing that was just like, look, this is the way, these are all the ways in which the case is like, the ways in which this documentary is like kind of is biased or whatever. But also watching it, I felt that it was like, it was really like quite horrifying. So like, there are multiple shots in it from the crime like scene video, I guess, where they just show
like real shots.
Yes, where they show like, they don't show, it's kind of covered up, but they're like, this thing on the floor here is like this child's body,
right?
And then they have like these long descriptions from this guy who is actually like a debunked suspect, but like long descriptions from him of like what he did to the child, like because he just basically made false confessions. These are shown again and again, put in again and again, in great depth, and you're like, this is legit about like a small child, like a 6-year-old child. And at the end of it, I was just like, this documentary is not at all concerned with the dignity of this dead child.
No.
Like they're just not interested in that at all. And I thought, the thing is, it's not even weird for it to be like that now. Like, you can do true crime, but I think because true crime is just everywhere now, people have sort of forgotten that they're talking about like real dead people.
Yeah.
And this is like a real child who actually was like a year younger than me. You know, like this is relatively recent. And they're just sort of talking about it in a way that I think kind of makes it even cheaper and even more horrifying than it already is. And I'm not one of those people where it's like, oh, you've got to make a true crime documentary, it should just be all about the victim, you know, and like we do a disservice to them by talking about the killer. Like, obviously people want to find out who the killer is, but but it is strange to me, like when you see something like this, I was like, this just kind of feels a bit depraved, even beyond like the kind of factual errors of the documentary. It was just the fact that I was like, I'm seeing stuff here that honestly just like nobody should see.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to see this fucking child's body. That shit is horrifying. And it's kind of become the norm. Like, that's just literally like a mainstream show on Netflix.
Yeah.
That's a bit demoralizing to me. But anyway, that's all I've got. That's the end of our show this week. You can catch us over on the paid side, where we will be talking signings for Arsenal, for Manchester United. We'll be bringing you our Christmas gift guides. It should be a good one. Thank you very much for listening. If you don't subscribe, please consider subscribing. And maybe we'll catch you over at patreon.com/patrickvs. See you later. Bye.